This show is a proud member of the Nerdy Legion Podcast Network. Get more at nerdylegion.com. Enjoy the show.
Carry on my wayward son. There'll be peace when you are done. Lay your weary head to rest. Don't you cry no more.
That's right, no crying anymore, because this is the Aftershock Central Podcast, episode 24, and we have got a good one.
I'm Jack, and Ronnie's with me, and Martin is his slack self again and is late, but it's all good because we have somebody way cooler than Martin this time. We have Adam Glass with us.
Hey, what's up? What's up, guys? How's everybody doing today?
What's going on, man?
Good. Where were you saying Martin was?
I just said he's late. He's slack.
Mm-hmm. You think I'm going to believe that? Martin, you're not a fan of the book, Martin? Where are you, man? No offense, guys. I was here for Martin. I'm so disappointed he's not here.
Make him feel guilty. We always try to.
He's like, that guy ruined Harley Quinn for me.
Yeah, but I guess, so you've produced some great TV series, Supernatural and Criminal Minds, but I guess most of our audience knows you from your Aftershock stuff, from Rough Riders and the Normals. I know.
I have a question first. I can't talk to Adam Glass without asking a Supernatural question because
I can answer it.
All right. So you were executive producer for what, season 1 through 6, right?
No. Through 6 through 10, so 5 seasons.
Okay. So and this sounds weird, but from season 1, episode 3, because I missed the first 2 episodes, but I went back and watched them, right?
Episode 3?
Yeah.
Dude, but I wasn't on the show then, but go on. Let's see if I can answer.
Right. But my favorite episode is episode 200, which is fan fiction.
Of course, Robbie Thompson. Great episode. I was there in the room when we broke it. Robbie's such a talented guy. He had the idea for it. And it's one of my favorite episodes, too.
Okay, cool. Because I know there's that fine line, either there's no gray area with that episode, either the fandom loves it or the fandom hates it kind of thing. So,
well, what I always thought is awesome about Supernatural is that it could poke fun at itself, right? I thought like it always had a sense of humor, and that really came from, you know, Eric, who created the show, Kripke. He always was great about that. You know, he'd say, let's kick the piss out of it.
Right.
And I thought he always did such a great job of that. And there's so many episodes that I think really do that, where the boys, you know, French Mistake, you know, where the boys find out they're actors on a TV show and that they're douchebags. You know, like Jensen and Jared are always so open to make fun of themselves. So it was really great. Like, you know, one of my favorite lines there was in 200 and in fan fiction. No, not fan fiction. And what was 200? No, fan fiction's another episode that Robbie wrote. He loved the fiction titles. But he wrote the thing, and the boys are talking and they're getting really close. And Dean's like, what's that? What's going on there? Now that's the boy melodrama. And he's like, you know, a little gay, you know, like, you know, it just played so into all that stuff. And once again, Robbie was so talented and was such a fan of the show himself.
Right.
So he turned around and really looked at the show through the lens of a fan. So I think that's why a lot of his episodes really land with the fans, because he was a big fanboy himself. I was a fan, but I mean, Robbie was like out of control fan.
Yeah. Yeah. So what, if you had to pick an episode, would it be one that you are on board with, or did you enjoy it more like out of the box looking in type thing?
Well, you know, it's really funny for me, and obviously, you know, you look at the episodes you wrote, you know, sometimes it was sort of the luck of the draw, but early on, I always liked, you know, and I think the show owes a lot to Buffy, which I was a fan of, and the X-Files and all that stuff that I grew up watching.
Right.
And I always loved what you call the Monster of the Week episodes. Like, to me, you know, I know people, and, you know, I'll be blasphemy for saying this. I totally think that, like, the Angels and the Devil stuff was all great stuff and really helped actually give the show. And Eric will say that they stumbled onto that, and it really gave the show the life that it has today. But I was always interested in sort of the in and out episodes and sort of the case of the week, the monster of the week episodes. So that's why I tended to write.
Right.
So those were always my favorites. And, you know, I wrote this thing, Bad Boys, that I really always loved, where Dean turns around and mm-hmm. we find out he was, as a kid, he sort of ended up in a, you know, in a foster home for like bad kids and, you know, right. and had a chance to sort of like an orphanage almost, you know, but he had a chance for a regular normal life and, you know, and then he goes back for his brother and real, you know, he gave up. So we realized, cause always we thought it was Sammy in college gave up the life and we realized, oh no, actually Dean gave up something.
Yeah.
And you know, look, I got, you know, both, I think sort of good and bad about this. You can't help but take your own life experiences and put it into the character. So, you know, right. A lot of that was me talking about things that I did in my childhood or anything like that. And I really related to Dean. I think it's not so much your favorite episode. I think it's like for me, and I actually had this conversation with Robbie just a few weeks ago. It's the episodes you didn't get to write. And so like when year five came up and I had written like 16 or 17 episodes, there was one more episode I really wanted to do that I never could get past the goalie. And it was, an episode where Sam turns around and because I really want to do a Sam episode because I always used to get crap for being like, oh, he just loves Dean. He's a Dean boy. I do love Dean. But I did really love Sam and I literally love Jared. I think he's such a good actor. But I wanted to do this whole thing where somebody back at Stanford, like basically like the opening of the show, like you have a college mm-hmm. couple and they're messing around in their dorm room. And all of a sudden Sam, not like just like what happened to Sam's girlfriend, the girl ends up on the ceiling and she burns and it gets the boys to go back to Sam's old stomping grounds. And when he shows up, also the mother of his girlfriend shows up because she too, and she's like, you know, saw it and like, this is familiar. So all of a sudden he has to confront his past
and
and I just really wanted to tell that story. And I never seemed to work. I always tried to do it. I also had a story where they brought Dad back and you realize that actually he's a shapeshifter, but he doesn't remember. He sort of like had an accident and he shaped into John but he really thinks he's John. So it's even more sad. And the boys really want him to be John. Mm-hmm. And so the end of the episode is they have to kill the shapeshifter who looks like their dad and is the closest thing they had to their dad.
Gotcha. So
like, I had a bunch of episodes I wanted to do that I never got to doing. With that said, also like co-creating the Men of Letters and the grandpa, you know, Henry in Time After Time. Like there were some episodes that I really, really feel blessed and lucky that I got to write and creating Abaddon and, you know, all those things. So I remember walking to my first Comic-Con and seeing a girl dressed as Abaddon. I was like, oh my God, I hated that. That's awesome.
Right. Yeah.
Like, you know, and so I always joke. I tell my wife this all the time. I really have to do something that is more successful in my life than Supernatural. Else when I die, by the way, it's going to happen. Anyway. They're going to be like Supernatural writer, Adam Glass.
You know? Well, see, that's funny that you mentioned that and we'll transition to why you're actually here. But like one of our listener questions was, since you being a successful TV writer, what made you want to get into the comics and write comics that way?
I've been reading comics since literally I'm 4 years old. And I said this in an article recently. It's a huge shout out to a guy who I have not seen or heard of. When I was four, I had a neighbor named Eddie Pagan. And this is in the Bronx where I grew up in a place called Pelham Parkway. And I grew up and my neighbor, this kid, Eddie Pagan, is a few years older than me, just loved comic books and he was nice to me. And he gave me his comics. And I remember the first comic I read, I want to say, was Tarantula and Spider-Man. You know, Black Tarantula or something like that. It was a shot on the cover and he's like kicking down on Spider-Man and like, you know, and I was just hooked instantly, you know. And so I've read comics like since I was a kid, like religiously. And I never hide my age. I'm 48. I came up at a great time. You know, I started with, you know, sort of the Neil Adams, you know, sort of Batmans and Detective Comics. And, you know, and then I moved on into the 80s and sort of like got into Teen Titans, you know, Mark Wolfman and George Perez,
right? Yep.
And Judas Contract. So during the last writer's strike, which I want to say was somewhere between 11 and 12 years ago, I was actually walking a picket line. You know, I was already a TV guy and I was walking, mm-hmm. right? I was actually walking and I met this guy named Mike Benson who was writing Moon Knight at the time. And we started talking and we hit it off and we're the same age and we read all the same comics and loved all the same stuff. And I actually shared the story with him that when I was a kid, my mom, I was raised just by my mom and my grandma. I didn't have a dad. And, you know, comic books were a real escape for me. And I never forget, I one day get called to the school therapist. you know, because apparently I had been locking myself in the room crying and been depressed, and my mom was like, didn't know what was going on. And so the school therapist talked to me for like an hour and a half, 2 hours, and I come home that day and my mother comes into my room and she's like, where is it? I want it now. I'm like, what are you talking about? And she's like, that freaking comic book, where is it? And why I was so depressed and upset was that Beta Ray Bill took Thor's hammer. And I was just so devastated by this. So I remember telling this story to Mike Benson, and Mike was like, you know, that. And as our relationship grew and as we're walking in the line, he started saying, you know, I'm writing this Deadpool book. I was like, oh, I love Deadpool, you know. And we started talking more and more about it. He's like, you should be writing this book with me. And I was like, oh, wow. Like, I really wish I could. He's like, well, I'm sort of, you know, I need help because I'm doing all these other things. And
yeah.
And like, could you come in and sort of maybe help? And he called Axel Alonso, and I had this whole conversation with Axel, and I sent a writing sample and all this. And at the time, I was actually on what was I on? I was on a show called The Cleaner. So it was like nothing or anything like that. So I went on it, and that was Suicide. That was Deadpool Suicide Kings.
Okay.
And so like, I really lucked out because I sort of, it was a great story. Deadpool couldn't have been hotter. It was a New York Times bestseller. And then me and Mike wrote a series of books together. I got to do Luke Cage Noir. I got to do Deadpool Pulp. I got to do some more Deadpool one-shots. You know, I'd done all these different stories. And then what ended up happening was I then moved on to Cold Case. And then after Cold Case, I moved on to Supernatural. And actually, I was at San Diego Comic-Con. And I know all the comic book guys because, you know, going to comic book stores my life and writers and you meet people. And someone said, you know who's a big Supernatural fan? I said, who? And they're like, Dan Didio. I'm like, get out of town. And they're like, so they introduced me to Dan. And Dan's like, why aren't you writing for us? And I was like, I'd love to write for you. You know. And so I started to write. So they had a Justice League annual, JLA 80th annual. And I'll never forget this story. I'm walking with my son into a comic book store and I get a call. And they're like, Dan Didio and Jim Lee's on the phone. I'm like, friends messing with me. I was like, right, sure. So, you know, I so admire Jim Lee. Always such a big fan of his. So I got on the phone. And they said, yeah, we need to do like a Supernatural-esque story for this JLA 80th. So I ended up doing this like Dante Inferno story for them. And they liked it so much. They said, we're doing this new thing called Flashpoint. And so I said, okay. And they were like, you want to do Legion of Doom? I'm like, yes, super friends, Legion of Doom. I'm so psyched. You know, Black Mantra and all this stuff. And they're like, can you meet with Geoff Johns in like an hour and a half? And I was like, yeah, sure. So I like typed up all my ideas and everything. So I go into this meeting with Geoff, who I'd never met before. He's a sweet guy. And I said, hey, I love Legion of Doom and Sinestro and all this stuff. And I have this idea. And he's like, yeah, none of them are in it. I'm like, none of them. It's like, I think Heatwave. I'm like, Heatwave from Flash's Rogues Gallery? He's like, yeah. So I wrote like basically what I thought was like, I wrote this prison story and he ends up like muling in Plastic Man who comes out of him, like, you know, like, and all this, and Plastic Man's a badass, an evil guy. And I just thought it was the most kick-ass like thing. Fans hated it. Like, I never, like, I never, like, I had such a privileged career up to that point. And all of a sudden, I'm, like, getting all the reviews, and people are just like, who is this guy? You know, TV Hollywood guy. Go to hell. And I was like, oh, my. But DC liked it enough that they said to me, you know, if you were to do any series, and they sent me a list, actually, of books. And I said, you know, when I was growing up as a kid, I was a big fan of John Ostrander's Suicide Squad. And they said, really, why would you do Suicide Squad? And I said, I think time and all this stuff. And I talked to them. I said, but I have one caveat. I think Harley Quinn should be in it. And they're like, why Harley Quinn? And I gave them my reasons why. And they went for it. And then it was sort of lightning in the bottle. Like, you know, sit here and say, I had no idea.
Right, sure. Yeah.
And that book really took off and sort of, you know, gave me, you know, I think coming off of that, I could really do
it. He did about 20, what is it, about 15, 20 issues of it?
20 or 21 issues, I can't remember, something like that. But what ended up happening, which was funny, is like the next move would have been like go do another big book, and I decided to instead go do independent books. So probably from a career point of view, people were saying to me, well, why are you doing that? Well, one, I was incredibly fortunate that I had a TV career. Right. And so it wasn't a money thing for me. So I just, after that experience, as good as it was, I just wanted to control my own universe. Yeah. And, you know, when you're writing a big book, you have to think about everything. Like, I remember we'd be in these story arcs we'd be doing, and then all of a sudden they'd be like, yeah, you got to do a crossover with Resurrection.
Right.
But I'm in the middle of my, and they're like, yeah, just wrap that up. And you'd be like, right. Oh God, you know? Right. And then of course the review would come out and they'd be like, and this story just dropped off. Out of last. You'd be like, shit. You know? I knew that that storyline had been told, but I now have been given marching orders. And in all fairness to DC, they have a whole universe to worry about,
So
for them, I understood, but for me, sometimes it was a little hard. So I got out of that, and I actually took about a year off of comics and just focused on my TV career and wrote some movies and did some stuff for the Weinstein Company and some horror films and all that stuff. And then when it was time to sort of say, hey, I have all these ideas, I knew Mike Martz from DC. He actually is the guy who helped me get Harley Quinn on the Suicide Squad. So Mike, I saw, was starting a new company. I reached out to him. I sat down. The first thing I pitched him in Aftershock was Rough Riders. And they said, don't pitch us anything else. We want to do that.
Yeah.
I was like, awesome. So,
And that book is fantastic, by the way.
Right. That's one of our favorites on this podcast for sure. Has been since you started it.
Oh, yeah. That's awesome, man. I really appreciate it. I love writing the book. I love history. I love those characters. It is truly, if everything brought me as much joy as writing that book, I'd be that.
So before we go to Rough Riders, though, I want to throw you a hardball.
Who throw me?
Because you're supposed to be politically correct and not ask this, but that's not how I roll.
No.
So since you've done some work with Marvel and DC, and this podcast network has a DC and a Marvel podcast, and we always jokingly sort of war between the DC and Marvel fans.
And I'm on both of them.
And Ronnie's on both of them. So which side would you pick? Do you consider yourself more of a Marvel or DC guy?
Well, you know, what's interesting is I actually have had this conversation before. When I was growing up, you read both. Like, nobody gave you anything. Like, so it's so crazy to me that it's become this, like, you're
left
either
– left or right side.
Yeah, either left or right side, because I grew up and you read –
My fault.
No. But, you know, and I say, you know, I think what you'd always say is, you know, I always say, like, yes, does Marvel have a more interesting lineup? In some ways they do, but I think DC has the greatest comic hero in Batman in comics.
Right, yeah.
So,
see, Martin's missing out. That's Martin's guy.
Yeah, that's, Martin loves Batman, so.
Again, Martin, glad you're missing this, man. Thanks.
Okay, that's a good answer, because if you only said DC, I was going to edit it out, but I guess I'll leave it.
Hey, look, man, I cried over Beta Ray Bill stealing Thor's hammer as a kid. By the way, I'll go. This is how nerdy I am, okay? Back in the day, I read every West Coast Avenger.
There you go.
Yeah. So, you know, that should say a lot about how much I liked Marvel.
So, you can see this.
Yes.
That is amazing.
And none of the listeners can, but I just held up a Rough Riders Nation copy.
And a picture of my shirt off, which was really weird.
So you tease teams from other generations in this book. Yes. And there's like a team. Well, it's the it's teams from the 1920s all through up to the 2000s. Will we ever get to see a story from some of these other teams?
You know, that's a question for Aftershock and Mike Morris.
Have you
picked? They called me tomorrow and said, write one. I'd do it in a second. You know, I've always said this about Rough Riders. To me, I've always had these four chapters in my mind. And I just finished the arc on the second chapter, which, you know, will be is the McKinley assassination one. And, you know, they always let me know usually – you know, towards the end of the run, you know, are you going to get another chapter? And I already pitched them the third chapter, which is really cool. It's Houdini was famous for breaking up spiritualism and seances and fake stuff. Right. And so really what the episode's about is sort of like a bunch of spiritualists and seance people who accidentally let something in and that they don't know about. So, you know, so it's more of a horror sort of episode and stuff like that. And so like H.P. Lovecraft's part of it and
awesome.
It's really cool. And it's Houdini who has to sort of go to everybody this time and get the team together. It says something evil has crossed over and we got to put it back in the box or things are going to get bad. Right. And so it's also sort of more of a Houdini point of view because it's been mostly Roosevelt, you know. He's always going to be part of the big POV. And at this point in his presidency too, he's in the middle of his presidency and very popular.
Right.
And then the fourth one is World War I and sort of the end of their lives and their careers and seeing them older and seeing them sort of thing. And so like my goal and my dream is to write all four chapters of that. You know, it'll depend on you fans. So go out and buy the book and make my dreams come true.
Yeah,
there you go.
And with that said, you know, if they ever wanted to do more, and like you said, take one of these other teams, the 20s team, 30 team, the 80s team. I love the evil. I love the 70s one.
Yeah, that's the 70s. Muhammad Ali, Evel Knievel, Teddy's daughter, right? Alice Roosevelt, Carl Sagan, and Bruce Freegan Lee.
Yeah.
That would be amazing.
That's like one of my favorites. Alice Roosevelt was such a fascinating character, and I talk about her a lot in the book. Her most famous saying, which I love, is she's known for this. She had it written on like on her pillow in her house. It's her biggest quote. If you don't have something nice to say about somebody, sit next to me. which I just love. It says so much about who she is.
Yeah, for sure. Are you a big history buff?
Giant history buff. I mean, I think the one thing about those books, you know, from the time I was a real little kid, I loved Houdini. Growing up a Jewish kid in New York, we didn't have that many heroes. And now we have Wonder Woman, by the way, which is awesome.
Yeah.
I tell it to my kids. I'm like, you don't understand. We were not hot and athletic and heroes. You know? Right. So I'm like, to death. Big shout out to Gal.
Yeah.
But
she was great, by the way.
Amazing. Amazing. But so I've always, Houdini to me was like really the first superhero. Like, you know, you really think about it, all the stunts and the amazing things he was doing in the 20s. And I imagine if you were a kid at that time, you must have looked at him like a Superman, you know?
Yeah. Right.
So I always loved him. And then Teddy Roosevelt's always been my favorite president. So I always was fascinated by him. And there's a famous picture of the two of them together on a boat. They met.
Oh, wow.
And from the time I was a kid, I always loved that picture and actually had a copy of it, used to hang it in my office. So I always wanted to do a story about the two of them. So when the time came to sort of put the Rough Riders together, it was really clear. I'm also a giant boxing fan, boxing historian.
Yeah.
And so Johnson, I knew everything about him.
Okay.
He was easy. Edison, you know, was the Steve Jobs of his time. You know, there's that great moment, Steve Jobs movie, where he says, you know, some people play the orchestra, you know, play in the orchestra. I play the orchestra. I mean, he really was, you know, he had an ego like no one's business, but you have to really look at it. I know I put it as a line in there, but it was really true. I mean, to him, the only two people who ever gave light to the world was him and God, you know,
right.
So
like, yeah.
He saw himself. And so he was arrogant. You know, he wasn't this nice, sweet old man. I mean, he was a businessman, and he stole a lot of stuff from people, but in his eyes didn't steal it because he gave them the place to work from it.
Right.
The person I didn't really know anything about was Annie Oakley, who, oh my God, talk about a badass. I mean, she, like, the more I learned about her, I was just blown away by her. I mean, she really is the closest thing to a mutant. I mean, she never missed. I mean, the Indians, you know, she did the Wild Bill show and she would tour with them. And like, you know, the famous Indians, you know, they just turned around and they just thought she was literally like a gift from the gods. Like, they just never saw anybody like her before. And just the way she carried herself, and a woman in that time, and, you know, she could drink with the best of them, outshoot anybody. She was truly an amazing character. Actually, the greatest story about her that's not in any of the books is William Randolph Hearst, who was the sort of head of yellow journalism in the Hearst papers, basically wrote an article about a woman with the same name in Chicago, knowing it would sell papers, who got arrested for vagrancy and prostitution. And so they put her pictures everywhere. They put it in, and he knew what he was doing. She sued him and went to court for 6 years and was the only person to take him on because it was her name and her reputation. And she took on William Randolph Hearst and the big papers and won. And they had to do a retraction. They pay her all this money and all that stuff. But that's the kind of gal she was, you know. Somebody once said she didn't do anything for – like, she never marched for women's suffrage, and she never, you know – turned around and was like part of any of those groups, but her life,
right,
what she was doing for women's suffrage. Like, there probably isn't women rights without an Annie Oakley. So, and which speaks to another part of it, is like in Annie Oakley, right? You have a woman, you have a Houdini, and you have African American in Jack Johnson. You have three others in a time where, so they, to me, they're the modern version of our story. They're the people that we can relate to and look back to, because these are three people who at the end of the day, you know, really were outsiders in their own society, and yet you know, worked their ways to a place where they were some of the most famous people in the world. And remember, too, this is a different time back then. You could count on one or two hands how many famous people there were in the whole world.
Sure,
right.
You know what I'm saying? So, like, you're and this team, five of them are there.
Yeah,
right.
It's not the TV generation, so word has to spread around slowly.
Queen Victoria, Mark Twain, you know, like, I'm just trying to think of that time. There was not that many famous people.
Right.
Right.
So it's, you know, that's the other thing about it that's really cool and interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. So do you already know a lot, or is there more like research that you have to do to make sure that you throw those little softballs in there, those little nuggets, Easter eggs, you know, in there to get it, to make it where it's alternate reality, but pretty much close?
Yeah. I try to stay emotionally true to what's really happening to the characters. And then I also try to take real history and put it in. I know most of it. Right. It's been very little research because my life has been the research. Right. I mean, I'm the guy who literally goes on vacation and reads, you know, The River of Doubt, which is, you know, Teddy Roosevelt's journey down the Amazon River, you know, after he lost the presidency. Like, I've always been fascinated by those kind of stories and have read all those type of biographies and have seen all those documentaries. Mm-hmm. So a lot of it I already know. And then I try to mix it. But I mean, that's why, interesting enough, I had a couple of school teachers come up to me at different events and they're like, I'm using your book to teach history in my class.
That's awesome.
Yeah, that's great.
Like, you know, like you're like, wow, thank you so much. Mm-hmm. Actually,
I'd go back to college for Rough Riders 101.
There you go. Well, it's funny. We were in Portland over Thanksgiving. It's where my wife's from. And we were in an Uber and I gave my credit card at the end. And the guy turns to me and he goes, do you mind if I ask you something? I go, yeah. He goes, you're not Adam Glass, the writer, are you? And I said, yes. He goes, oh my God, I'm an English teacher and I love Rough Riders. And I've been showing it to my school. And it was like, even my kids at that moment was like, oh, cool, Dad. You know, because, you know, your kids never think you're cool. Your kids
are right,
you and your comic books, you know. My son actually thinks it's really cool. I think my daughter, the crazy thing about it is when you do something like Supernatural, you actually I think I have like 62,500 followers on Twitter, which is predominantly Supernatural, you know? Right. So she always jokes because like if we go to a comic book convention or somebody comes up to me and like it just freaks her out. She's just like, oh my God, I don't understand why they want your autograph.
Yeah, Dad's doing dad things again. Yeah.
And then I'd embarrass her more. I just start dancing.
Oh yeah. Yep. See, I have 4 teenagers, so I know all about it. So
4 teenagers. You look like a teenager yourself. You must have started young.
I'm 40. First one was 20. So.
Money, yeah, that's Missouri, my friend.
Yeah, that's right.
So
wasn't much water here.
Now, with your background in TV, could you see Rough Riders as a TV series?
I gotta be honest with you, I always saw it as a movie. I just feel like it could do more as a movie, and it needs that kind of budget to capture the time in a real way. I feel like a TV show in some ways limited. Cut to me in a year from now, like, it's a TV show. I'm like, right. By the way, you know. I mean, look, if somebody came to me and said, you know, they wouldn't have to pull my arm too hard to make it into a TV show.
Right.
But my first instinct would be as a movie. I just think it needs that tapestry.
Because, see, I think we said, quote me if I'm wrong, Jack, but I think, well, for me,
you're
anyways.
Wrong. Okay.
I wanted it to be like the Netflix or like a short TV series. So that way, each episode was you can breathe instead of try to fit it in into 2 hours type thing. But I understand what you're saying with the budget type thing.
Yeah, you know, I just think like to really capture that time and the special effects that you would need for it.
Yeah,
it's such a big canvas to paint on.
Right.
That I think it would. I just personally think a movie would serve better. Yeah. And I think it should star The Rock as Jack Johnson.
There you go.
They're listening, Dwayne, call me, brother. Hit me up.
Now, why did you decide to give it a little bit of a humorous slant?
Well, I can't – look, anything I write and like actually, you know, and you know this from Supernatural and even in Suicide Squad, I always write things with a little bit of humor because I think actually some
Deadpool
of the best
as well.
Yeah, Deadpool too. I always think that there's – it's who I am. I try to think – being a smart-ass New Yorker, I always try to find it.
Have fun.
Yeah, have fun and what's the comedy and bus balls and all that stuff.
Right.
So I think it's a little bit of that. And I also think some of the characters, like I just once again said it, like, you know, I think I love writing Jack Johnson and Houdini together. Like, mm-hmm. I think they're a lot of fun together. They're two guys and, you know, those two, you know, busting each other's balls and talking and going, you know, what they're through. And like I said, being others and sort of both having found their ways, even sports back then being an entertainment business, you know, how do they get through? They're entertainment people. You know, you just have a sense of humor about life and everything. So I think, you know, you got Jack Johnson is literally at any moment could be grabbed by a mob of white people and lynched. And he doesn't give a hell. He doesn't care. Like, right. He lived his life that way. That's who he was. He was like, yeah, I'm going to gamble. I'm going to box. I'm going to beat white people up. I'm going to date white girls. I don't care. Come after me. He's such a modern guy in a time.
Right.
Really was crawling with racism, you know, and danger. And he sure. just – and he was funny, and everything I read about him was he was hysterical. He was a funny guy, a smart guy. And so I just stayed true to all that.
Yeah.
See.
Nick Wetmore, who's
yeah.
one of our – he's been on a couple of our podcasts a few times. Mm-hmm. He sent us a message that he wanted to ask you. He says, since Adam researches his projects – and does a quality job at it, does he ever release his research list so us readers can dive more into the subject?
Well, that's a great idea. I should do that. I mean, I would love if people reached in more and found that stuff out. Like I said, I mean, most of it is stuff I had already read. But, you know, if Aftershock ever wants me to put that together, I'd do that in a second. You know, I mean, there's so many great books out there, especially about Roosevelt.
Right.
Really, all of them, you know. One of my favorite documentaries is Unforgivable Blackness. I'm not even saying it right. It's the Jack Johnson one that they did on PBS, which is just tremendous and amazing. Who's the guy who does all the PBS documentaries, famous documentary?
Yeah, put me on the spot.
Oh, Ken Burns. Ken Burns.
Okay. Yeah.
So Ken Burns' documentary on Jack Johnson is one of the greatest docs you'll ever watch in your life. Like, so I would say that. Like I said, The River of Doubt is one of my favorite Roosevelt books, though. There's so many great ones. Tyrannus Rex, you know, there's just so many great things about him. Houdini, the first American superhero, is a great book. So, yeah, I mean, you know, just go out there. There's so many great material on these guys. And once again, what I think will really surprise people is how modern they'll come off to you. You know, I mean,
right.
Theodore Roosevelt's way ahead of his time. You know, I mean,
all of these characters actually are.
I agree. I mean, even look at Edison. I mean, he's creating things. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. He's creating the things using 150, 200 years later.
Yeah, Edison's the douchey businessman guy that we see pretty much every day now, you know? And back then, it was just, like, he was even like Wyatt Earp, because Wyatt Earp was the douchey business guy as well. But he was just a fan favorite then, you
know? Yes. Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, they wrote the best book about it.
Mm-hmm. So... I meant to lead with this question, and we were having such a good time that I forgot about it. But how did you get hooked up with Aftershock?
You know, one of the unsung heroes of my DC Comics Suicide Squad journey was Mike Martz. When I went to do Suicide Squad, I knew I wanted Harley Quinn in it, like I said. And I had to – Mike at the time was the editor-in-chief – not editor-in-chief. He was the editor in charge of the Batman family. So Patrick – Pat McCallum was my editor, and he said, you know, well, we got to convince Martz. You know, if we convince Martz, we could probably get it done. And so I remember having this like long conversation over the phone with Mike, and we got into the Batman family, and, you know, and I sort of had said something like, well, you know, these guys keep saying ground everything. You know, if Harley Quinn truly was a worker, an employee at this facility, you know, and was turned by, you know, a fellow inmate, I doubt very highly they would let her stay in the same facility, you know.
Right.
They would move her. I said, there's insurances, you know, problems and all that stuff. And why wouldn't they send her to Belle Reve? And here's why I think she'd be great on the team. And Mike was the one who went and fought for her and got her on the Suicide Squad. And without him, she wouldn't have been on the Suicide Squad book and she wouldn't have been in the movie. So, you know, Mike was the one who went to bat for her. So we became friends through that. And then, you know, I read that he had left and all that stuff. And I reached out to just say, hey, if you do anything else, let me know. I just always liked working with you. I thought you were a great editor and an even better human being. And he said, actually, I'm starting something. You're going to be at, you know, San Diego Comic-Con. And I met with him and his partners at this like outside Marriott bar near the thing and had a drink. And we sat down and like I just remember these tiki fire things going on and everything. And he said, what do you want to do? And I pitched them Rough Riders, and they literally were like, I said, and then my next pitch is, which was going to be the Normals, actually, funny enough.
Okay.
And they said, no, like, that's it. We'll do it. Like, all five of them were like, we're in.
Okay.
You know, and Mike will speak to this, you know, if you interview him or talk to him, he's like, it was the first time that, you know, someone had pitched them, and all five of them, without having talked to each other, all knew they wanted to do the book. So was really fortunate and found the perfect group of guys to do the book with. And overall, just an amazing company. Really support the writers and the artists and give you sort of, you know, the room to explore and create. And, you know, it's so rare
that
you find places. And, you know, Aftershock's just been so great at, you know, growing talent and allowing the talent and believing in the talent and letting us sort of do these stories. It's, you know, it's sort of a dream publisher to work with. I keep joking that they're ruining us for our next gig.
Did they have you pick your creative team, or did they do it, or did you do it?
Well, it's funny. You sit and you talk. I mean, once again, you're part of the whole process. So they'll give you a list of names that they've talked to. And, you know, especially for Rough Riders, it was Pat McCallum. Pat McCallum. It was Patrick Ola.
Yeah.
And I loved Pat's work. You know, I knew it really well. And I knew, and it was funny. I said, yeah. And they're like, you know what? We'll get him to draw something. I was like, yeah, you don't really have to. I love Pat's work. They're like, yeah, let's see his Teddy Roosevelt. And he said his Teddy Roosevelt. And we're all like, yes.
Yeah, sold.
Yeah. The guy.
Was it like the high-tech Teddy Roosevelt that he sent you?
No,
I want to see it.
The drawing, but there was just such strength in the drawing. And,
okay.
You know, and the thing about him that's great is, like, I remember, like, early on saying to him, look, man, like, I'm going to send you some stuff, and I just, you know, if it's too rough or too hard or too much, you let me know. And I remember I sent him, this really difficult sort of, like, you know, it was like, I want to say it was like the Hudson River and the Brooklyn Bridge and all that. And he drew the whole thing. I couldn't believe it. I was just like, whoa. He's like, I love researching. So both of us love to research. So that's, you know, really great. So, like, most of our emails aren't really about the books, for say, it's about the research. He's like, I saw this. And he sends me a picture. And I'm like, that's awesome. Here's a picture here. And, you know, have you read this book? And, you know, it's like we talk about it. So we're both big history fans. So I actually can't think of anybody that was born more to draw this book than Pat. And really fortunate to have him and Gabe and Sal. You know, it's hard to keep a team together. And
sure. We've
done sort of we've been fortunate enough to sort of do two chapters of this book, and we're hoping to do two more. So
okay. We're
hoping to stick together and do more. That's up to Aftershock and, you know, into the fans. Keep buying,
right. Keep
telling Aftershock you like the book, and maybe we'll be lucky and keep getting to do some more.
So,
yeah.
So do you consider it the second chapter or the second season, say?
So funny. Well, I think, you know, look, it's a book, so it's chapters, but in some way, yes, it's another way to look at it. You know, look, there's a lot of common with TV and comic books, you know?
Right, yeah.
They're different, yet they're the same, you know? You're trying to leave every chapter with a, you know, like, what's going to make people come back, with a cliffhanger for the next one. You know, we do that with TV and episodes of television, too. They're all little mini TV shows.
So is it easier? I mean, I don't want to say easy. Maybe that's not the right word. But is it easier to throw everything but the kitchen sink at, like, a comic writing than it would be, like, the TV? Because you actually have to have live action and whatnot?
Yeah, I think, look, I mean, you know, an example, and this might be a segue into the normals, you know, which is
you
only have 20 pages, you know, in a comic book. So I you know, and you have almost 55 to 60 pages in a TV series. So,
right. Like,
I feel like I learned this lesson after doing the first run at Rough Riders, you know, which was the first book one and two was really all set up. And book one came out, and, like, you know, people say, oh, don't listen to the critics. But, you know, I think we all read the reviews and hear all the podcasts. And everyone's like, interesting, but he, you know, I wish he would have put more into book one. So then I write the formals, and I'm like, I'm putting everything in the kitchen sink in the first thing. And everybody's like, it's too expositional. I wish it wasn't. See, it's like you learn you can't win either way. But for the story in particular, I wanted to be a little expositional because I felt like there was so much to get out. I wanted to get to telling the story.
Right.
So I felt like you had to get the backstory out to get it going. So I think the difference, like I said, is, like, it's in some ways it's harder to tell a story in 20 pages, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
And you have to have a splash and a 2-page spread and, you know,
right. All
tools of thumb. I remember when I was doing Suicide Squad, I would go back and look at all the old John Ostrander books that I loved as a kid, and I mean, there's no Suicide Squad without John Ostrander. He is the true hero of Suicide Squad. And but I remember, like, you know, they'd have 10 panels to a page, and there'd be, like, these huge, thick dialogue, you know, every page, but that's because it was a different time, you know, and that's the way storytelling was told. And so I was blown away because, like, you can't really get away with that stuff now. So, and not in a bad way, just we live in a different time. Comic books are told in a different way.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, I'm sort of the opposite. I was glad you sort of built up and sort of told normals. So you sort of revealed the twist at the end of this, of what I think, what we sort of think is going on. I like that because my perspective is a little bit different. I know number ones always sell the most, and then unfortunately with pretty much every title nowadays, it steadily declines to a point, and then you got your readers that sort of maintain it at some point. But that number one, if you don't hook people with that issue, then you risk losing your audience, in my opinion. And I felt like this issue did that really well. I had ideas of what this was going to be about, and I had seen the previews, and I wasn't sure. But by the end of this, I was sold.
Really appreciate that, and now you're my favorite person. So, Ronnie, you can jump off.
Martin and I were at C2E2, and you guys came on and did the panel.
Yes.
And what we perceived before hearing your description of it, actually in person, was different than what we were thinking that it was going to be. And so
me too.
It was great. Like you said earlier, like bad reviews, which I'm sure since it's your babies, you know, you see mixed reviews, but me personally, I've seen raving reviews about both titles, and especially like Aftershock seems like week after week here lately that their number ones have been blowing it away. And, you know, what, last week now, the normals came out and it seemed like it was getting rave reviews everywhere. And I'm hooked, you know, that first issue. I know that's what the first issue. I mean, I've been reading comics for 27 years now, but like, I know that the first issue is supposed to hook you in and get you going, but that one just seemed, it just sunk in and like grabbed me with teeth in, and I'm all in on it.
Yeah.
I really appreciate that, Ronnie. And now you're even more than Jack.
Checkmate, Jack.
Well, let me tell you how much I like it even more than I did before.
No, guys, stop fighting over me. Stop, please. In all honesty, you know, you put your stories out there and you hope that you get that kind of response. And, you know, look, I mean, I think any great story, will touch people. But I do think, you know, and I say this, Ronnie, because you sort of earlier talked about having a family. I think especially if you have a family, this really speaks to you because you can't help but relate. And if you're a kid in a family, it relates to you. And if you're a wife in a family, it relates to you because, you know, this idea of, you know, and you talk about that Comic-Con was in Chicago, right? And I was actually shooting a pilot there and I ran over, and on the way over, it sort of hit me. I was like, you know, I wanted to sort of hold off this reveal and not let anybody know that at the end they find out they're robots, because I sort of wanted that sort of, I wanted that mystery bit. And and then as I was driving over, I was like, but I had talked to the guys and they were like, yeah, the book's not really selling the way we want to sell it. And I'm like, well, I guess we better tell people what the hell it's about. And I realized that I made a mistake in the marketing of it by not doing that. I set up mystery and I put up all the stickers everywhere and that sort of great Londo cover and sort of like love, you know, and I just loved all that stuff. And thought, you know, we could hook people in that way. So you, actually, the thing you saw me at, I think, was the first time that I was really like, here's what it is about. Like, you know,
right.
I'm not, here it is, you know.
Yeah.
And let people know. And I've been getting that sort of response from a lot of people, which is like, oh, I had no idea it was about this.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was my experience as well. When I read the preview and whatnot, I was expecting something different. But
what were you expecting?
Something extremely normal. All the stuff I read, it seemed like a normal family going through it. It seemed like, you know, my life. And I was like, well, I kind of already experienced this. But when I read this and got to the end of it, I was like, okay, now this is almost like a Westworld-ish sort of the robots are finding out they're robots in the midst of this human environment.
Yes.
I don't know why it reminded me of Westworld, even though it's a completely different setting. Can you tell us anything about where you're going with that?
Yeah, you know,
without
it's funny.
Spoiling I guess.
One of the movies that really stood with me when I was a kid was Running on Empty. You know, I really remember loving that movie, River Phoenix and Judd Hirsch, and, you know, this idea of a family trying to stay together while they're on the run, you know, and this idea of like, what is family? And, you know, is it really about blood? Is it really about, you know, what makes it stick together? And, you know, I did also that 5 years on Supernatural, which is, you know, really at the end of the day, the secret of that show is it's a story about two brothers. You know, and how much will you go through family, you know, and what will you do to keep your family together? So this idea that, you know, if you haven't read it, spoiler alert, that this dad, Jack, who I named after Jack Sutherland.
All right. I've been waiting to get in a comic.
And is, you know, he finds out that this life that he has lived his whole life and this thing that he is all, you know, all his memories and this family and all this stuff, you know, they're sort of the perfect all Americana family, is really all a program, and that he's only been online for like 2-3 years, and it's sort of, you know, all a program. And but the truth is, like, somebody could say that to you, but, you know, and I think what we start to explore and as the book moves on is like, what does that mean? Like, it might be a program to you, but to me it's my reality.
Right.
You know? And I still love and I still feel and I still know who and what I am. And then, you know, when everybody else finds out the truth, does it keep us together, you know, or do we split apart over it? And then in sort of, you know, most sci-fi books, there is, you know, an outside force they have to worry about. So right. It really puts them in a situation where they have to decide how they move forward. And do they stay together as a family?
Right.
And so, you know, yeah, go ahead.
Oh, no, go ahead.
No.
I was just saying, like, to me, it kind of gave me like that the Truman Show kind of vibe. Not saying that that was a great movie or anything, or that's where you're going, but like I feel, because, you know, there's obviously more out there than what we're seeing obviously in the first issue, or maybe what we'll see in the first arc. There's got to be the producers or whatever that's out there, so I kind of got that type of.
You know, you're going to definitely get, we're going to build the world out a little more. You're going to find out why they were put where they were and what was the plan, and sort of like, you know, what is the next step in all this? And I think that hopefully will surprise people and keep people interested. Hmm. You know, I think I spoke about this a little bit at the thing you were at. You know, you know, one of the nice things I've been reading about the reviews is how real it felt. Well, it feels real because I'm writing my worst fears of losing my own family. You know,
right.
These are my kids and this is my wife and this is our relationships. And so I, you know, my son, you know, I talk about Aiden having dyslexia. My son Aiden has dyslexia, you know, so like all these things, you know, my daughter is at that age where, you know, she's becoming her own person, as you know, starting to lose her. And yet you have to let them go a little bit so they can become the people they're going to be. So, you know, I'm really writing this from my heart. And at the same time, also through the lens of like my greatest fears, like, you know, I've gotten to this point where I don't want to lose this.
Yeah.
You know, that's why I've been with that great Talking Head song. Like, there's a part of me is like, how did I get here? You know, I feel like it was only yesterday I was, you know, downing, you know, 6 packs of beer and taking bong hits in the college dorm room. And now somehow I'm, you know, this like responsible dad, and I have a house and I have a family.
Right.
And I'm happier than I've ever been in my life. And then, you know, it's the old saying, it's like, you fight so hard to become king, and then how do you stay king, you know? Yeah. So it's really just all coming from a real place. And it's like, it's like, what if I took my family and put them in a science fiction story?
Right.
And what would that look like? So that is what I'm doing with this. And really just enjoying the hell out of it. And, you know, it's funny, someone asked this recently. I'm doing something also with this book that I've never done before. I'm a guy, I plan it to the T, and I'll write 1 through 6 in like a month. Like, I'll just sit down, and also because of my schedule, I'll just say, this is the month I'm dedicating to these books, and, you know, and I go over them, and I write manically, and, you know, book a week. So usually it takes me 4 to 6 weeks to write something. This one I wrote the first 5, and then I said, you know what, I'm not going to write the final book yet. I'm just going to step back, and I'm going to see the art come in. I'm going to see the response to it. I'm going to see how the book goes and moves on. And then, like, we're about to put out book 4. I'll write the finale, you know?
Right.
And I know in my head sort of what I want it to be, but I'm glad I did this, because I think it's probably helped change also where I wanted to go with it, because I had to think about it and let it sort of, you know, bake in my head a little longer. And it's going to be really cool and some great twists and turns. And I think it'll be, you know, everyone will really dig it and it'll leave the story open to keep moving forward, you know, yep. Or be closure for some people if this is all it lives for is six issues.
Right.
Yeah. And for me, it felt like from page one to the last page, like we got there organically. I know that's ironic since we're talking about robots, but like, you know, some, not necessarily with your books, but like some comics, you know, you like we were talking about earlier, how when you were doing for the big two, you know, that you were getting into Flashpoint, so you had to change the story arc or where you're going or whatever. Yeah. But like, I think those books, and with both Rough Riders and with the Normals, it seems like whenever we go somewhere, we get there organically and nothing's rushed or forced.
Well, I appreciate that. Yeah. I mean, I really try to do that with the books, and it is definitely something that I have tried to do. You know, I mean, in your writing, you want everything to feel real and as organic as possible, and the characters to be emotionally truthful. So I appreciate you saying that. I mean, it's definitely something that I'm going out of my way to try to make work, and glad for you it is.
Yeah. So as a writer, I know I've heard like Dan Slott say this and other big writers say this, but like if you would have knocked out 1 through 6, right, would you have just left it? Or are you that type of writer that has to go back and is never done until it's never perfect?
Oh, I hear you. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, there's the book you pitch, there's the book you write, there's the book you rewrite once you see the drawings. Uh-huh. You know, you're always fine-tuning it, you know what I'm saying? Right. Like, for me, getting those first six stories out, usually for me, just helps me spit it out. And then when I sort of, it all comes back to me with the art, there are certain things I know, excuse me, that I want that I'm not going to change. And then there are just things that, that, you know, you see it and you're like, oh, that doesn't work.
Or, yeah, right.
Or, I didn't think of this, but now that I see it drawn this way, you know, look, I'm really lucky. You know, Dennis Calero is a really great artist, you know, and he's drawing this in a very noir style that I really appreciate and love. And, you know, one of the moments in the book one that really stuck with me, and I sort of hit him when I saw it, was he, you know, there's this great scene after Mary and Jack discover what's going on with their kid, at least that something's wrong, and they go back to the room to talk about it. Mm-hmm. And he draws it all from behind them, almost like your us, the reader, is we're able to sort of like take a peek, you know, being out into this private conversation, you know. Right.
We're the fly on the wall.
Yeah. And it's great, you know. And and I remember when I saw the pages, I was like, yes, this is awesome. And look, some of the stuff, like the whole eye thing where the kid's falling out, and then like I wrote that in the script, and Dennis, of course, executed it unbelievably. And then, you know, Adriano Augusto, who's our colorist, you know, just also is just knocking it out of the park on this series.
Yeah.
But then there are other stuff like that scene that's pure Dennis. Dennis just sort of bringing his expertise to the book and really being able to sort of, you know, just blow us out of the water with that stuff. So really great team and great collaboration by all involved.
Like I said, I'm excited to see where it goes. I punched my ticket. I'm along for the ride. So,
well, I really appreciate that,
Dan. Is this ongoing, or is it have a?
Well, you never know. I mean, I have it as an ongoing in my head, and either it'll be ongoing, or it'll be my fan fiction that I write and stick in my Facebook.
Right. well, if that happens, send us the conclusion.
I was gonna say I don't own it anymore, so then I'll get sued. Right. But I really appreciate that you guys are digging it, man. I love writing it. You know, I love writing it and Rough Riders. You know, I've said it before, and you know, if I could get paid to write these kind of things and everything I did and make a great living at it, man, I'd be the happiest person in the world.
Yeah. Well, hey, we want to respect your time. I don't know if Ronnie has any more questions, but is there anything else coming up that you want to mention with Aftershock or even anybody else?
Well, not me personally. I mean, obviously, I've got still, you know, a bunch of Rough Riders that are coming out, and, you know, I'm hoping to get a third arc on that. I'm finishing up the second arc right now. And then, obviously, more of the Normals. And I'm working on a new TV show for Showtime called The Shy, which will be coming out next year. And in the middle of developing a bunch of projects, and fingers crossed that I'll be bringing you more and more TV as the days and the years come by. I really appreciate it. Both you guys, man, I can't thank you enough, Ronnie and Jack, and thank you for all the stuff you guys do for us and for Aftershock and being fans of our stuff. It's a great company, and guys like you help make us go out there and write and want to make it great. So,
hey, it's guys like you who make our job easier to promote for you guys.
Thank you, bro.
Thank you.
All right, you guys have a good one.
Yeah,
you
thanks, too. Adam.
We would like to thank Adam for coming on and doing an interview with us. Super cool. We hope you guys enjoyed it as much as Jack and I did.
I hated
Martin's,
it.
Martin's slacking and missed yet another interview. But if you want to tweet your hate at Martin, it's at Geekvine. If you want to tweet your love for us,
yep,
it's either at Jack Sutherland, at Rombar316, or you can tweet the show at Aftershock Pod.
Yep. See ya.
And that's about it, I think, right?
Yep.
Now, everybody, go get Rough Rider. Get caught up if you haven't. Nick Wetmore, I'm talking to you. Get the normals. Yeah, I don't know. I'm just rambling now, so.
Shout out. This one goes out to all my bros back home. Michael Sparkman, Juan, bro, I couldn't do it without you. Nick Wetmore.